Near the highest elevations, the Pedregosas offered shelter in many forms. Deep caves ran through the bowels of the earth. Steep-walled canyons crisscrossed the mountain range, providing a network of passageways where Naiche and his followers could stay out of sight while moving ever southward, although almost never in a straight line that would have made their journey that much shorter. Here, Naiche felt relatively safe from the doggedly determined white men who had been glued to their trail since they broke away from the reservation and entered the dragoons. His sense of safety, however, was not shared by Chakotay or Nana, and Juh seemed unusually watchful now. Naiche had abandoned his plan to lay an ambush for the white men at the base of the mountains. He would select the right spot when he came upon it, and then prepare a deadly bushwhacking for the White Eyes, from which he was certain they would not escape if they were mere mortal men. Chakotay scouted the trail ahead. Nana, the most experienced warrior in Naiche's dwindling band, brought up the rear with two young warriors, staying back a mile or more, climbing to higher crests and ledges to watch patiently for any sign of the three pursuers. As the day wore on until the sun was directly overhead, Naiche relaxed more and more. The maze of snake-like canyons they followed were ancient pathways to the land of Mexico, known only to Apaches who once roamed this rugged terrain. The white men had found it easy to track shod cavalry horses in sand and softer ground. But in the heart of the Pedregosas, dark rock had been carved by wind and water since the beginning of time. Even a shod horse left little more than scratches on the surface of stone-bottom ravines and gullies. Stunted juniper and pine grew on higher slopes, appearing to be clinging to walls of rock with nothing but roots to hold them in place. The Pedregosas were one of the driest mountain ranges anywhere in Naiche's experience, and only someone who knew where to look would be able to find the scarce water for animals and men. Naiche's calm was soon interrupted when Chakotay came galloping her pinto mare in his direction. He could tell by the way she pushed her wiry little mount that she'd seen something amiss in the trail ahead. He rode far out in front of the line of pack horses and mules to reach her, hoping she was not bearing bad news, yet all but certain this would explain her haste. Chakotay pulled her pony to a halt in front of his bay, and then pointed back down the canyon from which she had ridden.
I saw two of the White Eyes, Chief Naiche. They rode across the top of a ridge in plain sight. They did not try to hide from me.
It was puzzling news. Two of the whites who had proven to be so clever allowed themselves to be seen against the skyline.
Why did they show themselves?
It is a trick. They wanted us to see them, to follow them, thinking we would behave recklessly. I am sure they meant to lead me into an ambush.
You are very wise, Chakotay, not to follow them. What else could it be besides a trick to lead you to a spot of their choosing, where the other whites would kill you with their rifles?
My heart told me this, not to follow them. But this is also a sign that somehow, even without knowing these canyons, they have gotten ahead of us. They will be preparing an ambush where they believe we must travel.
Juh rode up to overhear the conversation.
What is wrong?
Two of the White Eyes rode across a high ridge in plain sight. They took no measures to stay off the horizon where no one would see them. It was a trick.
We will be forced to turn east or west to ride around them.
They must be mounted on good horses. Only a strong animal with speed and endurance could get past us. Juh, go back and tell Nana. Leave the younger men to guard our rear. We will need our best fighters to confront them, and our best trackers to find out where they are waiting for us in the canyon.
I will look for their tracks. My eyes are still young enough to see the hoof prints left by a white man on a horse with iron shoes. After I bring Nana to you, Naiche, I will go alone to find their horse sign.
Naiche, let me go with Juh. Two pairs of eyes are better than one. I can show him the ridge where I saw the tall man on his black horse and the white man with long red hair.
It was the red-haired one? And McAllister you saw?
The revelation caught him off guard. The prisoner left to die in the desert said that Falcon McAllister was an Indian fighter from the northern regions. Perhaps McAllister was not as smart or as cunning as they first thought to ride out in the open. But how had Mickey Free gotten ahead of him to join McAllister? Capri and the soldiers were still far to the north, according to his scouts.
Yes, the one called Falcon. He did not look down in the canyon even once when he crossed the ridge, and I knew then it was a trick to lure me to the place where they meant to kill me. The man with the red hair rode behind him.
You're wise. From up high on the rim, a good rifle shot could kill many of us. It is time to change direction when we come to the next fork in this ravine.
Just studied the canyon wall south of them, the direction they had intended to take. His brow furrowed.
But it is impossible for them to overtake us. These mountains are too rough for a horse to travel so quickly to take riders past us. We've covered many miles, and we still cannot outrun them.
I saw them clearly, Jaw. The one called Falcon and Mickey Free rode across the ridge. They rode slowly, giving me much time to make sure who they were.
Naiche remained silent. If Chakole, Jah, Nana, or any of his followers believed they were being chased by spirit warriors from the Land of Shadows, their will to fight would be broken. Free was a human man, known to be such by all Apaches. But what of McAllister and the men with him? Could they be ghosts from a distant past who fought the Apaches long ago?
Look for their tracks!
I will bring Nana.
Yes. Tell Nana to ride with you, to look for the tracks made by Mickey Free and McAllister. But do not follow them away from the ridge. I will lead our people to an offshoot canyon, where we will ride in a different direction.
It was then Naiche noticed that Chakole was reading his face very closely.
What is wrong?
I believed I saw fear in your eyes, Chief Naiche.
You are wrong! It was only the angle of the sun. I am not afraid of these foolish whites or Mickey Free. When we find them, we will kill them. Their blood will spill the same as any other's. Find their tracks on the ridge. When our people are in a safe place, I will follow their tracks and kill them myself.
Mickey Free reached up and rubbed the back of his neck.
I tell you, Falcon, it do make my neck itch to have a bunch of heathen Apaches behind me and me not doing anything about it.
I know what you mean, Mickey. It was real hard not to let that female and the others with her know we saw them down there in the canyon.
Falcon reined Diablo up at the edge of the precipice overlooking a deep canyon filled with juniper pine and other scraggly specimens of trees. Most of the vegetation in the Pedregosis was withered and yellow, barely able to survive in such a dry, inhospitable climate.
This has got to be the ugliest country I've ever had the misfortune to set eyes upon, Falcon. Even the snakes and scorpions look embarrassed to live here.
I guess that's why the Apaches have been the only people who ever tried to settle in these mountains.
The Apache are dumb enough to live anywhere. They're animals. Hunting and eating and breeding, that's all they think about.
Why do you hate the Apache so much, Mickey? I know they took you when you were a child, but there's got to be more to it than that.
You ever talk to somebody who's been in prison, Falcon? Someplace really bad, like Yuma Territorial Prison? All they do is complain that the food was bad, the guards were mean and brutal, and they were worked too hard. That's nothing compared to what those bastards did to me every day for 10 years. I got scars on top of scars till I don't hardly have no feeling in my back anymore. Beaten, starved, worked until I dropped every day. Treated worse than the mangiest cur in the village. It was a hell that I prayed every day to be delivered from. There was this squaw, a little bit of a thing, called Onasha. She wasn't real bright, kind of like her brain never grew to catch up with her body. Well, she got to be nice to me, would bring me water when it was hot, things like that. One thing led to another, and me being a normal boy of about 16, with all the cravings of the flesh that go with that age, one day I just kind of grabbed her and tried to kiss her. One of the young warriors saw what happened and ran off to tell the chief of the tribe.
What'd they do?
That night, they gathered the entire camp and made me strip naked and stand in front of them while the squaws all laughed and pointed at me. Then they brought Onasha out of her tent, stripped her naked, and did the same thing. After a while, with her crying and bellerin', not really understanding nothing of what she'd done to deserve this, the young warriors all took her out in the darkness and had their way with her. Afterwards, they slit her nose to show she was dishonored, a whore. She ran off in shame, and I never saw her again. Don't know if she killed herself or what. And all because she was kind to a White Eyes.
They're a hard people. They have to be to survive in places like this.
A few minutes passed without either man speaking.
Now tell me again why you think the sight of the two of us is going to make Naiche turn his entire band of renegades around and head back into the trap the army's setting for him.
They'll do it because we're the unknown. Naiche knows what to expect from the army. Every time he's gone up against him, when he's had the proper weapons, he's beaten them. So the army holds no fear for him.
But we do.
Well, Naiche must know you're here by now. And you're about the most famous Apache hunter and killer there is. And every time he's sent warriors up against me, they've come back dead. That's gotta worry him some. Maybe enough to make him change his direction away from Mexico and back toward where Major Jones has the army waiting for him.
What if it don't?
And you and I are in for some heavy fighting. Matter of fact, I do expect a small war party to come up here looking for us. My bet would be that Naiche will send 4 or 5 of his most trusted and experienced warriors to sneak up on us and see if they can kill us.
No wonder my neck's been itching. What do you figure on doing about that, Falcon?
Why, we're gonna disappear into thin air.
Falcon stepped out of his saddle and handed Diablo's reins to Mickey.
Here, lead my horse over there toward that trail that heads back into those arroyos.
As the Indian fighter walked the horses off, Falcon picked up a dead juniper tree branch and followed along behind, walking backward while erasing the animal's hoof prints in the fine sand and dust. Once they were on the harder packed shale and rock, he climbed back onto his horse. When they looked back, their tracks walked up to the edge of the canyon and then disappeared, just as Falcon wanted them to.
What now?
Now we find some cover. Some place we can defend if Naiche's war party manages to find us.
They headed deeper into the maze of arroyos and small canyons that made up the Pedregosas, making sure to keep the horses on ground that would show no prints and leave no trail. Several hours later, Chicole followed Jun and Na with 3 other warriors as they trailed the white men. Nana often had to get off his pony and get down on his hands and knees to find the tracks in the areas where the ground was hard, to where the sand cover had been blown away by the ever-present winds. Chicole watched the 2 old warriors' every move. It was always possible to learn something of tracking from men as experienced as these. Between them, they had over 100 years of living and fighting the white man. It was almost like magic to the younger warriors how the old men could track horses over this terrain when they could see nothing. A broken twig, a dislodged pebble, the smell of horse urine where animals had relieved themselves, sprinkles of tobacco spilled when making a cigarette. All these things were noticed by Judd and Nana as they followed the white eyes deeper into the Pedregosas. Finally, they came to the ledge overlooking the canyon where Chicole had been when she'd last seen the pair. Jun and Nana got off their horses and bent low to the ground, spreading out in ever-widening circles, shaking their heads and talking softly to one another. After a while, they walked back to the edge of the cliff and looked down into the canyon, as if looking for bodies that might have fallen off the ledge.
What's wrong? Where did they go?
There are no further signs. The tracks of McAllister and Mickey Free end right here.
We have searched for 50 paces in every direction. There is no sign they left here.
Men and horses cannot fly.
You are correct, Chicole.
Just stared out over the canyon. Then he pointed high in the sky where a pair of hawks soared overhead, riding air currents while looking downward toward Earth.
Men and horses cannot fly. But spirit warriors from the Land of Shadows can.
You talk like old women around campfires at night. Mickey Free is no spirit warrior. He is merely a white man who takes pleasure in killing our people.
But what of McAllister? He walks without making a sound. He kills warriors who lie in wait to kill him without being seen. And he walks his horse over the edge of a cliff and disappears into the air. Is this not the behavior of a spirit warrior?
Chicole felt goose flesh prickle the back of her arms. Joe was spooking her, as well as the 3 warriors with him. She saw him looking over their shoulders and gripping their many-shoot rifles so hard their knuckles were white. This would not do. She could not allow this old man to bring fear into the band led by Naiche.
Enough! Even if, as you say, McAllister is a spirit warrior, what of Mickey Free? His tracks also disappear.
Perhaps McAllister killed Mickey Free and made him a spirit warrior also. Or perhaps he wrapped his arms around Free and his horse and carried him aloft with him. Who knows the ways of spirit warriors?
Chakotay pointed toward a faint trail leading down into some arroyos and canyons.
Let us search this way. Perhaps your eyes are merely too old to see the signs that are there.
She heeled her pony down the trail, looking back once to make sure the others followed her as she made her way down the side of the mountain toward the maze of canyons running in all directions. Nana looked toward the heavens, silently praying to whatever gods he believed in to keep him safe from spirits that killed silently, and then took wings to escape their pursuers. Juh merely kept his eyes on the ground in front of them, perhaps hoping he might find some sign showing he was dealing with mortal men after all, and not some demons from the afterlife. They progressed this way deeper and deeper into the rabbit warren of canyons and arroyos, with Chakotay and Juh and Nana leading the way, and the three warriors bringing up the rear. In the third canyon they searched, they came to a sharp bend in the dry stream bed they were following. After Chakotay and Juh and Nana turned the corner, the first of the three braves in the rear pulled his pony to a halt, levering a shell into the firing chamber of his Winchester.
What is it, Kota?
I heard a twig break in that bush over there.
He carefully trained his rifle at a thick bramble bush intertwined with a half-fallen-down mesquite tree. Turning quickly at the sound, Kota's bowels turned to water as he saw the other two warriors lying bleeding on the ground, their throats cut. Two white men sat astride their ponies. Kota opened his mouth to scream just as a long, razor-sharp knife struck him in the chest. Kota stared at the knife handle protruding from his chest, then at the man in black who had killed him. He fell from his horse to join his friends in the dusty caliche and sand of the stream bed. Falcon jumped off the Indian's pony and bent to retrieve his Arkansas toothpick from the dead man's chest. Mickey slipped off his pony and looked up at the ledge overhanging the canyon. He and Falcon had waited there until the warriors were in the right position for him to leap down upon their ponies and kill him. Mickey shook his head.
I swear, Falcon, jumping down on those horses was like something out of a goddamn dime novel.
Falcon used a branch to brush away their footprints before he and Mickey clambered back up the wall of the canyon.
So now you feel like Black Bart, the famous stagecoach robber, huh, Mickey?
Black Bart was never crazy enough to try something like that.
They had barely scrambled out of sight above when Chakotay, Juh, and Nana came galloping back around the bend in the trail, their rifles held out in front of them as if they expected trouble. Nana saw the three warriors lying in the dirt. The kills were so fresh, one of the men was still bleeding, his lifeblood pumping out of his throat in a crimson stream to be soaked up immediately by the thirsty soil.
Look, Chakotay, the spirit warriors take wing.
Nana raised his rifle, nodding his head to some inner rhythm only he could hear.
Be still, old one.
Chakotay cocked her head to the side as she listened, hoping to hear hoofbeats or any other sound that would convince her they were not dealing with spirit warriors. She had never believed much of the drivel spouted by the old ones who sat around the campfires, amusing the younger children with their tales of spirits and gods and other supernatural things. She was always more sensible, believing only in the strength of her mind and the fierceness of her hatred for all things brought by the white man. She got down off her pony and could find no signs or tracks in the dirt. The hair on the back of her neck stirred, and she felt the first glimmerings of fear. Perhaps they were dealing with spirit warriors after all. Who else could kill three of their bravest young warriors without making a sound? After stripping the bodies of their rifles and knives, Chakotay, Juh, and Nana rode as rapidly as they could back toward where they thought Naiche would be. At first, Naiche was so furious that Chakotay thought he might shoot them all. But then, When he heard Juz's story of the hawks and later the quail, his face blanched white.
Even Geronimo, as great a leader as he is, cannot fight the spirit warriors.
Tell the people we turn back.
But Naiche, the army is back there. That way lies sure death.
Naiche looked toward the sky, searching to see if any hawks were soaring above to overhear his orders.
Better to die facing an enemy that can be killed than to be taken to the land of shadows by spirit warriors and have no chance of an honorable death.
Do not listen to the old one's tales, my chief. I am sure if we push forward, we will prevail and be able to join up with Geronimo. Then the two greatest chiefs of the people will lead us to victory against the White Eyes.
Naiche turned to face her, and both his eyes and his visage softened as he looked at her.
It is too late for that, Chicole. For some reason, we have angered the spirit world, and it sends warriors to defeat us. Warriors against whom we have no chance, for they can neither be seen nor heard when they come to kill our young men. Our only chance is to defeat the Bluecoats and then proceed to meet Geronimo along some other path. Perhaps if we show enough bravery in our fight with the white-eyed soldiers, the spirits will forgive us and lead us to our destiny.
Chicole, with tears in her eyes, took out her knife and slashed it across her left forearm. She sleeved her arm across her face, smearing it with blood, then held her bleeding arm high above her head. She turned to face the other warriors in the camp.
We go to meet the white soldiers, to live or die as the gods decide. Who will follow Chief Naiche with me?
The warriors all took out knives and slashed their arms, holding them aloft.
Damn it, Mr. Meeks. We're the cavalry. We're supposed to do our fighting on horseback, not hunkered down in the bushes and behind rocks. I don't hold much with bushwhacking. That's the way the Indians do their fighting.
Jasper glanced at Hawk, whose face screwed up with an expression as if he'd tasted some week-old milk that had turned to vinegar.
Excuse me, Captain. I know you horse soldiers are real proud of yourselves, but tell me, just how much luck you had fighting the Injuns your way?
Jones blushed a deep crimson.
Well...
Way I hear tell, you plumb got your butts kicked butt good the last few times you went up against Apaches on horseback.
You arrogant bastard!
Easy there, Captain. It's no shame to have lost a battle to the Apaches. Hell, the only people on Earth meaner or better fighters than the Apache are the Comanche. Now, the point Hawk and I are trying to make to you is, the only way to beat the Injuns is by playing by their rules. Strike when they don't expect it, and strike from hiding when you got them boxed in twixt your riflemen, where they don't have no place to run to.
Yes, indeedy. That's the way we've been doing it with Falcon, and we had some damn good luck with it.
But how do you know where the renegades will come from?
Jasper spread out a map of the Pedregosas on the ground and pointed at it with his finger.
Look here, Captain. This trail we're guarding is the only one that's relatively level for 10 miles in either direction. The way I hear it, Naiche is traveling with women and children in his group. My guess is he'll try this trail rather than have all them people try to climb up and down canyons and arroyos.
And that brings up another point, Captain. Better tell your men not to hesitate to shoot at the women and even the bigger kids. It don't make much difference whether the bullet in your brain is fired by a brave or a squaw. You're just as dead. And I sure as hell don't want to end up with a tomahawk in my back because some of your boys is being a gentleman.
Suggestion noted, Mr. Hawkins. Sergeant, assemble the troops. Mr. Hawkins and Mr. Meeks will show you where to position them for maximum effect against the hostiles.
Yes, sir!
Jesus God, I hope these boys can fight as well as they salute.
Naiche led his people down the trail northward. His plan was to exit the Pedregosas and turn southwest, staying on the desert floor until they had traveled a safe distance away from the spirit warriors, then turn back south and cross into Mexico there. He hoped they would be able to do it before the army caught up with him, But in any case, he figured fighting the army was less dangerous than going up against the spirit warriors, who had been killing his men a few at a time now for weeks. The column of his people was spread out in a thick line for several hundred yards, with Naiche, Chicole, Ja, and Nana leading the front, and the rest of the young warriors bringing up the rear as a guard against a rearward attack from the spirit warriors. Chicole glanced around her as she rode, looking at the tall cliffs of the canyon walls on both sides.
I do not like this trail, Naiche.
Naiche looked up and to the side, but his mind was clearly elsewhere.
It will be all right, Chicole. The enemies we have to fear are either behind us or out in front of us.
But what of these confined canyons? They would be perfect places for an ambush.
The white soldiers are too dumb to do as we do in battle. That is why, with the aid of the many shoot rifles, we are so easily able to defeat them.
If the White Eyes could fight like the people, then we would have much to fear. But as it is, their leaders are men with little courage and no honor. In our last battle, their chief ran from the field to save his own life, leaving his men to die.
That is something an Apache would never do.
Captain Jones, from his vantage point high on the canyon wall, let the entire procession get within the jaws of their trap before he took out his saber, held it high over his head, and brought it down in a slashing arc. Immediately from both sides of the canyon, withering fire from the soldiers hidden there rained down on the Apaches. Nana's throat was pierced by a slug, killing him even before he realized they were under attack. Judge's shoulder was grazed, the force of the bullet turning him half around before he raised his rifle and began to return fire. Naiche's horse reared up on its hind legs at the first gunshot, thus saving the chief's life. He levered shells into his Winchester and fired as fast as he could pull the trigger. Chicole saw the way ahead was blocked by two men in buckskins, standing in the middle of the trail, firing into the crowd.
Naiche, come this way!
They both pulled their ponies' heads around by jerking on the nose reins and galloped toward the rear of the column as fast as they could. They were not abandoning their people, merely trying to find a way to lead them to safety. As they neared the bend in the trail behind them, two men rode out into the open. One had hair the color of a blazing sunset, braided in two braids in the Apache style. The other sat tall in his saddle astride the biggest, blackest stud Chicole had ever seen. Naiche jerked back on his reins, a look of terror on his face.
It says the spirit warriors!
I will take the one with the flaming hair! The other is yours!
Chicole leaned over her pony's neck and heeled its flanks hard, pointing the Winchester ahead with one hand. Mickey Free, seeing Chicole's charge, charged at her, an Army 44 caliber pistol in his right hand. Yeah! Chicole's rifle clicked on an empty chamber. She was out of ammunition. She threw the rifle aside and pulled her knife out, holding it high overhead as she continued to charge Free. When he saw her throw down her rifle, he holstered his pistol and pulled his bowie knife out, spurring his horse until blood flowed from its flanks. As they passed each other, they both swiped with their blades. Chicole's knife cut a shallow slash in Mickey's right arm, while his knife slipped through her neck muscles all the way down the bone, severing her right carotid artery. She continued riding for 20 yards as if nothing had happened, then tumbled off the pony, dead before she hit the ground. Naiche saw Chicole fall. He took a deep breath and charged at Falcon, firing as he rode. Falcon leaned low over Diablo's head and kneed the big stud into action, straight at Naiche. Halfway there, Diablo stumbled in a depression in the ground. Falcon, caught by surprise by Diablo's faltering, was catapulted over the horse's head onto a patch of sand. Unable to believe his good luck, Naiche reined his pony to a halt and took careful aim with his rifle at the spirit warrior. Just as he pulled the trigger, the red-headed spirit warrior rode between them, taking Naiche's bullet in the side of his own chest. As Naiche levered another shell into the chamber, Falcon rolled over onto his stomach and drew his Colt. Firing by instinct, Falcon put two slugs in Naiche's chest. The third shot hit him between the eyes, blowing out the back of Naiche's head and sending hair and braids flying. As soon as he saw there was no further danger, Falcon scrambled to his feet and ran over to where Mickey lay, holding his chest.
Damn, that hurts!
Falcon cradled Mickey's head in his arms.
You crazy son of a bitch! Why'd you do that?
Just repaying an old debt. I owed your pappy one for saving my bacon a few years back.
Diablo came on the run. Falcon got to his feet and reached into a saddlebag and brought out a slab of fat-back bacon wrapped in a cloth. He took the meat and placed it over the hole in Mickey's chest, holding it tight.
Oh, shit. And here I thought you was gonna fix me my last meal.
No, but a doctor once told me if you covered a chest wound with meat or lard, sometimes it'll seal the hole and let it heal. I figured it's worth a try.
Well, damned if I ain't breathing better. Hell, now I'm gonna owe you two. You goddamn McAllisters, just keep on getting me in your debt.
Well, it could be worse. It could have been Buford Jones who saved you.
You're right, Falcon. That'd be unbearable. Oh, shit! That smarts.
Falcon found Doc Holliday at his usual place, playing poker at the Oriental Saloon. All in all, Doc looked better than he usually did.
Howdy, Doc.
Doc looked up and grinned, then took a deep draft from the whiskey bottle that was always by his side.
How'd it do, Falcon? You had to sit in for a spell?
No, I don't like to gamble with friends, Doc. It hurts me too much to take their money.
Me neither, Falcon. Of course, that still leaves me a whole shitload of people to take money from.
Well, I'll be seeing you, Doc.
Hey, wait a second, Falcon. Did you hear the news?
What's that, Doc?
I hear they found Johnny Ringo stuffed in the fork of an old oak tree. A couple of 44 slugs in his chest.
Any word on who killed him?
Well, I swear I don't know, Falcon. The way that boy talked, there wasn't anyone in the territory who was fast enough to get the drop on him. Or maybe the poor boy just shot himself out of shame for the way he's acted all these years.
Falcon cocked his head.
Doc?
Anything is possible, Falcon. Anything is possible.
Cry of Eagles is a Graphic Audio production. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Copyright 2007, William W. Johnstone. Performed by David Coyne, James Lewis, Terrence Azelford, Richard Rowan, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Colleen Delaney, Michael Replogle, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, and Christopher Graybill. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Vocal editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler. Script adapted for graphic audio by Casey Jones. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Be sure to look for our other graphic audio titles, available at Roadstops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for an episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Mark Dalton Series Copyright, 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 2, Highway Robbery.
Highway 17 was as clear as the sky that filled his windshield, and it looked like it was going to be another beautiful day. Mark Dalton checked his mirrors for oncoming traffic one last time, then shifted his Peterbilt into first. He signaled left and began the run through the gears, taking his time to bring the rig up to speed. Although he'd let the engine warm up for a good half hour while he'd done his circle check, it didn't make sense to push it if he didn't have to. His Peterbilt 379, which he affectionately called Motherload, was already 6 years old, and if he treated her right, she just might be with him for another six, maybe even longer. Mark smiled at the thought. He hadn't always been so careful with his women, but he learned from his mistakes. Just 2 years ago, he'd been working as a private investigator, making a good living, videotaping men who spent three-hour lunches with their secretaries and women who spent more time with their personal trainers than they did in the gym. The money had been okay, but the work had taken up a lot of his time, especially nights and weekends. That had become painfully obvious when he set up his camera one night outside a motel room on the lakeshore and discovered he was taping his own wife in bed with another woman. That little episode had taken a lot of the fun out of being a private detective, and suddenly Mark needed to find something else to do with his life, at least for a little while. He'd been driving off and on for years whenever he wasn't working on a case, so as soon as the divorce was finalized, he sold off all his assets and bought a 92 Peterbilt with a fully equipped sleeper. Driving a rig was just what he'd needed. He could work as much or as little as he wanted, and when and where he wanted. And perhaps most important of all, he had only himself to worry about. And even that seemed like one too many at times. But old habits died hard, and he wasn't adverse to getting involved in other people's lives, maybe even sticking his nose into a few places where it didn't belong. Like that woman walking along the side of the highway up ahead. What's her story, Mark wondered. What's she doing out here in the middle of nowhere?
Well, there's only one way to find out.
He slowed the rig as he came up behind her, and she turned to face him with her arm extended and her thumb pointed in the direction he was headed. He slowed the Peterbilt further, pulled off the highway, and came to a stop on the gravel shoulder. He waited there for her, watching her grow larger in his mirror. Before she reached the truck, he turned on the CB and switched it to Channel 9, on the off chance there might be some news about the girl being a runaway or an otherwise missing person. Pretty was the first thought that came to Mark when the young woman's face appeared through the passenger side window.
Hi.
Where are you headed?
West.
Just west?
Yeah.
Now that sounded odd to Mark. Usually someone all alone out in the middle of nowhere was headed somewhere. They might have been dropped off by someone headed someplace else, or been walking between rides, but they always knew where they were going. He looked at her for a few seconds.
All right. Hop in.
Thanks.
She didn't flash him too much of a smile, and that wasn't right either. Someone walking alone for a while is usually thrilled to get a ride. She struggled to get into the cab, and while she tried to make herself comfortable, Mark noticed that her shoulder-length ash-blonde hair needed combing. She had a white t-shirt on that had some sort of tropical fish on the front of it. The shirt was spotted with something dark and, like her black denim pants, was in need of a wash. The black and white running shoes on her feet had mud on them, and she wasn't carrying anything with her besides the gray summer jacket she had draped over her arm. Mark waited until she settled into the seat before heading back out onto the highway. When they were on the road and up to speed, he waited for her to start up a conversation, but she didn't seem to be too interested in talking. What she did seem to be interested in was the highway in front of them, which she scanned like some eagle on a perch.
So, how is it that you came to be on the highway this morning?
My car broke down.
Huh. I don't remember seeing any cars on the side of the road for at least 20 miles in either direction.
I got a ride from somebody.
Now, that was possible, but if she got out of someone's vehicle, then she must know where she's headed, or at least where she's not headed. And even if she did get a ride, that wouldn't explain why she looked so beat up. There were cuts and scrapes on her face and arms, and her dirty white t-shirt had a big tear on the left shoulder. And despite her seemingly tough exterior, Mark couldn't help but notice that there was a look of fear in her eyes.
Look, Miss...
Jane.
Don't tell me. Your last name's Smith.
How'd you guess?
Okay, Miss Smith. A lot of what you're telling me just doesn't add up. Now, either you tell me something I can believe, or I'm just going to let you off at the next crossroad.
Attention all drivers. Attention all drivers. Just want you to know that the OPP are looking for a woman who skipped out on a motel bill outside of Huntsville. Seems she also left some guy behind in pretty bad shape.
Mark glanced over at her, and she raised her eyebrows in an awkward look of surprise.
Does that mean he's dead? Can you ask him?
Mark wasn't sure what her interest in this guy was, but he obliged her.
Is the guy in the motel room going to make it?
Affirmative. He's been worked over pretty good, but they figure he'll pull through all right. The girl the cops are looking for is white, mid-20s with shoulder-length dirty blonde hair. She's wearing black and white shoes, black pants, and a white t-shirt from Marineland that's got killer whales on the front of it.
Mark leaned forward and took a closer look at the front of her t-shirt. Damned if what he thought were tropical fish weren't killer whales.
You mind explaining...
Shut up!
Her right arm suddenly appeared from under her jacket. There was a gun in her hand.
Just keep driving.
Mark kept his eyes on the road, but managed to steal a couple of glances at the woman, Jane Smith, who was sitting in the passenger seat next to him and pointing a gun at his head. The gun looked a little on the small side, nothing more than a .22, if that. Her hand was shaking, and the fear he'd noticed before in her eyes had spread to the rest of her face. If he wasn't behind the wheel of his rig, Mark might have risked taking the gun from her. She didn't look like she'd be much of a shot, for one thing. And for another, Mark had a gut feeling she didn't have it in her to pull the trigger. But even if he was crazy enough to try taking the gun from her while they were out on the highway, not only did he risk getting shot, and at this range, who could miss, but he could wind up putting his rig on its side, and that kind of trouble he needed even less than a hole in the head.
I seen her. Skinny thing. Kinda pretty. Didn't know where she was going, but seemed to be in an awful hurry to get there.
So this girl's been around, thought Mark, sneaking another glance to his right to see if the second trucker's words had any effect on her. She didn't flinch, and the gun remained pointed at his head.
I gave her a ride from Huntsville to North Bay, but she jumped ship when I stopped for fuel. Stole my starter's pistol out of the glove compartment, too.
Mark lifted his foot off the accelerator and turned his head to take a better look at the gun. Sure enough, it wasn't a gun at all, but a reasonable facsimile looking just real enough to get people's feet and hearts racing. With slow, even movements to ensure the gun wouldn't go off and set his ears to ringing, Mark reached over and took it away from her. For a moment, her empty hand trembled wildly in the air. Then it moved to her head as she cradled her skull with both hands. He picked up speed again and drove along for a few kilometers in silence to give her time to settle down and collect her thoughts. There was obviously more to this whole thing than just some guy being rolled in a motel room, and Mark was curious enough to know what it was. By the time they reached Cache Bay, her sobs had turned to silent tears. Mark figured she was about ready to talk.
Now look, I can imagine you've had a pretty rough morning. But if you don't start telling me the truth about what's going on here, the next stop will be the OPB detachment in Sturgeon Falls. You want that?
She shook her head.
Good. Now, what's your name?
I told you.
Your real name.
Jennifer Mitchell.
Mark waited for her to say something more, but it was becoming obvious that extracting information from her would be like pulling molars.
And how did you come to be walking along the highway?
I was riding with my boyfriend on a run into Winnipeg. He asked me to come along to keep him company and to see a bit of the country.
Yeah?
But he didn't seem to be enjoying my company much.
Why not?
He was constantly watching the mirrors.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Even when we were parked?
Oh.
You see, Rick did an 8-week course with a school to get his A license, and he did really well at it. We figured, with the way companies are in need of drivers these days, he'd be able to get a job right away, but that's not the way it worked out. The best companies want drivers with experience, and you can't get experience unless somebody is willing to take a chance on you.
Mark gave an understanding nod. He'd heard similar complaints plenty of times before.
So, one day he met up with a high school buddy of his in a donut shop in downtown Toronto. Rick told the guy he was having problems getting work, and the guy said he'd see what he could do for him. A couple of days later, he calls Rick and offers him this honey of a deal.
Mark had a feeling he wasn't going to like this honey of a deal one bit.
This guy and his partners would loan Rick the money to buy his own used rig. On top of that, they promised to give him as much work as he wanted. 2 or 3 times a week to Rochester, as many times as he could handle.
Sounded great. But Mark knew that anything that sounded too good to be true usually was.
Rick was so happy to have the work that he never bothered to really find out what he was carrying. The boxes and paperwork said there were cameras inside, and since Kodak is based in Rochester, well...
Well, what?
When he realized there was booze and cigarettes inside the boxes, he didn't want any part of it. He told the guys who lent him the money that he knew what he was carrying for them and that he didn't want to work for them anymore. He promised to pay them back any way he could, and they seemed to be satisfied with that.
But?
But Rick didn't have any contact, so even though he had his own rig and a bit of experience, it was tough finding enough work to pay them back on schedule. He ended up missing a few payments, and they came looking for him.
So these guys were following your boyfriend?
Yeah. They got him to do one last run. Then they were behind us all the way from Toronto. After I went to get us some breakfast this morning, I came back to find 2 guys working over Rick. One had a tire iron, the other one a knife.
And you stopped them?
Yeah, well, not really. When they saw me in the doorway, they stopped beating on Rick and came after me. I threw hot coffee into the face of one of them and managed to get away.
What about the blood on your clothes?
There was a lot of it in the room.
But if you managed to get away, why didn't you go back for Rick? Or at least call the police?
Rick was dead! Or at least I thought he was. And I knew the cops would be looking at me like a suspect, thinking I'd made up the story about the 2 guys. And then what about them? They were looking for me too, because they knew I was a witness and would be able to identify them.
Mark thought it might be true about them coming after her, but he didn't buy her fear of the police. Despite the few run-ins he'd had with hard-headed cops as a private detective, Mark knew they weren't all stupid. They would have been able to check out her story and would have started looking for the 2 men by now. She obviously needed help, so why wasn't she asking for it?
Is there something you're not telling me?
I wanted to get to the truck before they did.
The truck?
It was Rick's and my future.
The truck?
Yes. It was locked, but I wasn't going back to the motel room to look for the key. So I waited until they took the truck. Then I caught a ride with another trucker, hoping to catch up to them.
Her words were cut off as she suddenly became interested in the rearview mirror outside her window.
You really think you'll find them?
Yes, I do. In fact, it looks like they found me.
Mark took a look in his own mirror. There was a big blue Freightliner cab over in the left-hand lane with the name Jennifer painted in fancy lettering between the bottom of the windshield and the top of the radiator grille. There was smoke pouring out of the rig's twin pipes, and the driver looked to be in an awful hurry.
That's Rick's truck coming up behind us.
Fear began to creep up Mark's spine. If the truck coming up fast behind them was indeed Rick's, that meant the man behind the wheel was a cold-blooded killer. Even though Rick hadn't died, the 2 men had entered the motel room with the intention of killing him, which meant they were guilty of attempted murder at the very least. And if they were willing to kill a man to settle an outstanding debt, what else might they be willing to do to get rid of the only other witness to their crime besides the victim? Mark pressed down hard on the accelerator, and the rate that the Freightliner was approaching slightly slowed. Mark sighed, realizing he'd never be able to outrun them, even if he wanted to. He was loaded front to back with china and dinnerware for a restaurant supply company in Saskatoon. His rig and the 53-foot trailer it was pulling was already at its 80,000-pound limit, and there was no way he could stay at this speed for long. The other truck would overtake him in minutes. And if they knew that the girl, Jennifer, was in his truck, they might try to run him off the road. Once they'd done that, they could kill them both and make it look like part of an accident. But he reasoned. If they were going to try and run him off the road, they'd be in for a surprise. Because if Mark had anything on them, it was weight. A truck full of cigarettes and booze was no match for the tonnage amassed by skidfuls of china plates. He eased off the accelerator. No sense in burning out the motor just to postpone the inevitable. And the Freightliner started to catch up.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. What do you think they're going to do? Do they even know you're riding with me?
Although unlikely, It was possible they'd seen her get into his cab, or they might have heard something over the radio. Then again, it was also conceivable that they were just in a hurry to get to Winnipeg, deliver the load, and sell off the truck. Mark checked his mirror and saw that the Freightliner was now even with the rear of his trailer.
Hurry, quick, get in the back.
What?
Get in the sleeper, I don't want them to see you.
She got off the seat, climbed into the sleeper, and pulled the curtain shut. Mark looked over his shoulder and saw that she was peeking out of a slit between the curtains. The Freightliner was just about even with him. Mark looked over at the driver. It was a young guy, unruly dark hair, dark glasses. His face looked a little red, and his white short-sleeved shirt had a huge stain around the collar and down the front. He was either an utter slob, or he'd recently had coffee thrown in his face. Mark was apt to believe the latter. Mark's fingers tightly clenched the wheel as he waited for something to happen. His knuckles had begun to turn white, and his palms were aching, but he wasn't about to loosen his grip. At last, something happened. The driver of the Freightliner smiled at him and gave him a little wave, just a friendly how you doing. Mark took a deep breath, eased off the accelerator again, and watched as the Freightliner moved ahead and then pulled over into the lane in front of them.
All right, you can come out now.
No, the other one's behind him.
Mark checked his mirror and saw a burgundy Buick LeSabre come up on the left, then tuck in behind the other truck.
That's their car!
So they would be getting rid of the truck in Winnipeg. Probably even had somebody lined up to strip it down and ship the parts halfway around the world. Mark watched the truck slowly pull away and decided not to chase after it.
Can't you keep up with them?
I'm not blowing my motor just to keep up with somebody I'll be catching up to later.
What do you mean?
Well, they're gonna have to stop sometime.
But what if they turn off before Winnipeg?
Mark thought about that a moment and then turned to look at her. Why is she so worried about the truck? If anything, she should be wanting to head back to Huntsville to be with her boyfriend, Rick. God knows he could probably use the company right now.
And just what is it with that truck, anyway?
What do you mean?
I mean, while your boyfriend is in some hospital wondering if his brain is ever going to work right again, you're riding cross-country after some truck. What's so damn special about that truck?
She climbed back into the passenger seat and leaned her shoulder up against the door before speaking.
We're engaged. We were going to get married as soon as Rick paid off this guy's loan.
But you said he was late making the payments.
Then we would only have to pay the money back to his parents.
What? You borrowed money from them too?
When his father found out the kind of trouble he was in, he offered to loan Rick the money to get him out of a jam. He mortgaged the house and gave Rick the money in cash.
Cash?
That's the way they wanted it.
Oh boy.
We were going to make the payment when we got back from Winnipeg, but they caught up to us in Huntsville and...
Why didn't you just give them guys the money and be done with it?
I'm sure Rick tried to, but I think he mentioned going to the cops a couple of times too many.
Oh, gee, you think that might have been a mistake?
How naive could this guy Rick have been? Or maybe he was just crazy. Or stupid. Or both.
So, instead of just taking their money, they decide to take the truck, the money inside it, and kill Rick, just in case he thinks about going to the police again. Oh, that's nice. Real nice.
Up ahead, the Freightliner rounded a curve and was gone. A moment later, the Buick following it also disappeared from view. That started her crying again. Mark felt bad for her. She seemed like a nice girl. And all her and Rick had wanted was a chance to get started on their lives together. And here were a couple of bad boys all ready to take advantage of two kids' dreams. Rick was probably clinging to life by a string in some hospital, and they were about to lose not only what they'd invested in the truck, but all the money the kid's family put up to help him out as well. At this rate, they'd be paying back their debts until the day they died, and even that might not clear it. And for what? So a few people could cheat the government and save a few bucks on their booze and smokes? Mark wanted to comfort her, wanted to say the right thing, but he was never good with words, so it was best not to try. On the other hand, it might be possible for him to help her, to actually do something for her. That was his strong suit, taking action. But what could he do for her out here on the highway? Just then, they came upon a long straight. Ahead in the distance, over on the right, was a truck stop. As Mark neared, he looked for the big blue Freightliner cab over in the lot. Sure enough, it was parked in one of the service lanes, taking on fuel. He looked at his own fuel gauge and saw that it was still 3/4 full.
I think maybe I could use some fuel.
He pulled off the highway and into a whole lot of trouble. Mark slowed his rig to a crawl as he neared the service area of the truck stop, giving himself extra time to think.
What are you going to do?
I don't know yet.
He had an idea or two, but no real plan. The blue Freightliner was parked in one of the fuel service bays, getting topped off with fuel. The Le Sabre was parked behind it, probably needing a fill-up as well. Mark looked over to the restaurant and peered through the windows to try and see what things were like inside. It was busy, which made sense considering the number of cars and trucks out in the lot. Slowly, a plan began to formulate in Mark's mind. It was the sort of plan that might get him killed, but it was the only one he had at the moment, and he might as well go with it. He turned into the lane to the left of the Freightliner, pulled his tractor ahead of it, then turned right, blocking the other tractor's exit route. Mark got out of his truck.
Hey, what you think you're doing?
I know this guy.
He climbed up on the side of the truck, pulled on the door handle, and looked in through the window.
I hauled a load for him last month, and I'm still waiting on the check.
The attendant nodded and busied himself with filling the Freightliner's tanks. Obviously, he didn't want to get involved in a dispute between two truckers, especially one over money.
Hey, where'd he go? Did you notice?
He's getting a coffee, I guess.
All right, thanks.
Together, Mark and Jennifer headed for the restaurant.
You know what you're going to do now?
I'm still not sure. I guess it depends on what we find when we get there.
Before going in the restaurant, he looked in through the windows.
Do you think these guys are good with their fists?
They didn't seem to have any trouble holding Rick down, and he's 6'1", 190. Even did some wrestling in high school.
If he was smart, he'd just call the police and wait for them to sort things out. But if he did that, one of the two would get away in the Buick, maybe even both of them. Besides that, he wasn't the kind to sit around and wait. He had to do something.
Do you think he'd recognize them if you see them?
I already see them. They're at the back of the line on the right.
Mark looked in the direction she nodded and recognized the driver with the coffee-stained white shirt. The guy standing next to him had to be the driver of the Buick.
So let's go.
Hey, hold on a second. Let me just think a minute here.
It was obvious he wasn't going to be able to hold these guys by himself. He needed help, and all he had was a restaurant full of truckers. But that might not be such a bad thing.
Maybe I could use that to my advantage.
The whole situation reminded him of the climax to the movie The Fugitive, where Harrison Ford finally catches up with the bad guy in a hotel ballroom full of people. Instead of confronting the guy in the ballroom, Ford's Dr. Richard Kimball tells the guy he'll be waiting for him in an adjoining room. That's just wrong. The only way to confront someone in a room full of people is to do everything in plain view of hundreds of eyewitnesses.
Here.
He gave Jennifer a quarter.
Call the police. Tell them that...
What?
Now, the truth would be too confusing to explain in such a short time.
Tell them there's a lunatic in this restaurant and you think he may have a gun.
Jennifer took the quarter and made the call. Mark took a moment to gather up his courage, then grit his teeth together and head into the restaurant.
You! You're the one!
The guy with the coffee-stained shirt put a finger to his chest and started looking around for the police.
Oh, me? You drive a blue Freightliner cab over with twin pipes, dark blue detailing, and the name Jennifer painted on the front?
Maybe. Who wants to know?
Well, the cops, for one. You're the guy who put a friend of mine in a hospital by driving him off the road and into a ditch near Armprior.
Where?
Don't play stupid with me. You heard what I said. He accidentally cut you off trying to avoid a car that pulled in front of him. You blasted him with your horn, and he made the mistake of giving you the finger. So you ran him off the road and into the ditch. A guy with a wife and three kids now has a busted jaw, broken neck, and 2 cracked vertebrae. Eats his dinner through a straw, all because you wanted to get even.
The truckers at the nearby tables had all stopped eating. They were listening intently to Mark's story, even grumbling and heckling every once in a while.
Look, buddy, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, and I don't want to know.
Don't give me that crap after your reckless driving put my friend in the hospital. You know, it's guys like you who give the rest of us hard-working truckers who drive by the rules a bad name.
Yeah, we're gonna let these guys
pay. His plan might actually work. While he couldn't be 100% sure, at least now Mark felt like the other truckers were with him.
Yeah, whatever. Come on, let's get out of here.
Mark didn't want it to get physical if he could help it, but if he didn't do something soon, the two of them would be walking right out of the restaurant.
Where do you think you're going?
Mark pushed Coffee Stain hard in the chest with both hands. The guy looked like he wanted to fight, but was so far resisting the temptation. Obviously, he didn't want to risk losing the truck, the money, and his load in some truck stop brawl over something he didn't know anything about.
Look, pal, I'm getting in my truck and getting the hell out of here. If you're smart, you'll step aside and let me go.
Not until you say you're sorry for what you did to my friend.
It sounded silly, Mark knew, but it was all he could think of at the moment.
Screw you!
Mark was all ready to push the guy again, but a strange thing happened. A group of truckers had moved in behind him, blocking the two guys' only way out of the restaurant. Apparently, drivers around here didn't take too kindly to fits of road rage, especially when they put one of their own in the hospital. Coffee Stain and his friend started to push their way through the crowd. The crowd pushed back. Without warning, Coffee Stain pulled a knife. Everyone started backing away. Everyone except Mark. He remained standing where he was and took a good look at the knife. In addition to being very big and very sharp, it was also spattered with blood. Rick's blood, no doubt.
Get out of the way. I don't want to have to cut you.
I don't want you to have to cut me either.
Good, then get out of my way.
No.
Coffee Stain took a step forward, and Mark took the starter's pistol from his pocket and pointed it directly at the guy's forehead. The crowd withdrew even further. Some were now scrambling out the door.
Take it easy, man.
You put my friend in the hospital, and now you want to cut me too?
Look, I just wanted to get out of here.
Drop the knife. On your knees. Both of you.
Mark took a look out the window. Still no sign of the police. He turned to the two men, now on their knees.
You know, guys like you really piss me off. For every 200 safe drivers on the road, there's one jerk like you who screws it all up for everybody.
Okay. I'm sorry, all right? Just don't shoot me.
Oh, I see. You want me to show you some mercy? Like the mercy you showed Rick in that motel room in Huntsville?
Coffee Stain's eyes grew wide and his face turned white. Jennifer stepped out of the crowd and stood at Mark's left.
That's right. I know what you did, and I'm here to even the score.
He had no answer to that, other than raising his hands in surrender. Mark ignored the gesture.
Ready? Set, go.
Slowly, another darker stain began to appear in the middle of Coffee Stain's pants. At that moment, two police cruisers, lights flashing, pulled up outside the restaurant. Mark knew he would have some explaining to do, but not nearly as much as Coffee Stain and his friend.
Be sure to look for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. In May, Episode 3 appears in Deathlands No. 23, Outlanders No. 40, and Doomsday Warrior No. 1.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.